Hello and welcome to my podcast if you're a new listener or an old friend. We're in a series in Hebrews 11 at the moment, looking at what faith is. Now, it's common today for people to define faith as a leap in the dark or something you need to switch your brain off to have. That's a pretty weak argument, and it's not how the Bible defines faith. So listen in as we look at what the author to the Hebrews has to say. As always, feel free to send any questions or feedback my way. The details are in the show notes. So let's begin. Well, over the last few Sundays, we've been looking at Hebrews chapter 11. And we've been thinking about the word that comes up there many, many times, the word faith. We've seen that faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. It's in the unseen, but it's anchored in what God has said, knowing that he is trustworthy. We also saw that faith is the only way to please God. There's no other way to do that. And then last week, as we thought with the children earlier, we were thinking about forward-looking faith. Faith like that of Abraham, who lived in light of the future, in light of what God promised would happen. And that faith, Abraham's faith, it looked beyond the grave, looked into the future, trusting that death was not the end. And this was a good reminder to the original readers, the original hearers of this letter to the Hebrews. Back in the chapter before, back in chapter 10, we'd seen that they were believers who had faith, but they were enduring conflict and suffering, insult and persecution, prison and having their property taken away, all for following Jesus. Well, this morning we're going to continue to see what this chapter teaches us about faith. We're going to see some of those things we've seen already as we go through, but we're also going to see that faith chooses to identify with the people of God to receive the promise by running after Jesus. That's 3 points there if you didn't pick up my commas. So let's have a look at our first point, which will come up on the screen. There we go. My first point this morning, which is faith chooses to identify with the people of God. We see that in verses 23 to 38. Now, we all choose to identify ourselves with something. And we all do it in a number of ways. I don't know if you've thought about this before. Perhaps the most common way is through our clothing or through our electronics, that you wear the colour of your favourite team. You have a symbol embroidered on your T-shirt. You have a logo prominently placed on your mobile phone. But it also works the other way around. Sometimes we do things to make sure we're not identified with someone or something. We take a Waitrose carrier bag into Aldi. We choose to walk slowly behind someone in town that we recognise so they don't see us and we're not associated with them. See, we all choose to do things to identify ourselves with something. And choosing to be identified with something was an issue for these original hearers of Hebrews. It was because they were known for being Christians that they were facing these trials. And so the temptation was for them to shrink back from their association, to throw in their branded towel, to give up on following Jesus. But those of faith choose to identify with the people of God. We started to see that idea last week. We saw that Abraham had left his homeland, his place of safety, his people, to go where God had told him to go. And the final verse from last week ended with Joseph. Do you remember that? Joseph, who at the time was the prime minister of Egypt, one of the superpowers of the then world, having his bones taken to the promised land, identifying himself with the Israelites rather than with the Egyptians. And Joseph started to point us forwards last week to where we are this morning, towards the Exodus story. And that's where we end up in our first verse this morning, in verse 23. Have a look down at it with me. Hebrews 11, verse 23. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. This verse reminds us of the opening of the book of Exodus, after God had made those promises to Abraham of descendants more numerous than the stars, we begin to see that happening at the start of Exodus. But that causes problems for Pharaoh at the time, and he decides to kill off any Israelite child the moment they're born. And that's why Moses' parents hid him for months. Being the father of a one-year-old, I can not imagine how you can do that. You can just hear the noises of screaming now, but in doing so, they chose not to fear the king's edict. They set themselves up against the dominant culture, against the ruling party, the Pharaoh. They chose to identify with the people of God. And the same goes for Moses in verses 24 and 25. You could say, like father and mother, like son. It's one of the ironic stories in the Bible where Moses, who's meant to have been killed by Pharaoh, ends up living in his house instead. The little Israelite boy who was meant to be dead was given the benefits and the privileges of living in the house of one of the world's superpower rulers. Just imagine what that would have looked like. I reckon it would be similar to the position that our Prince George is in. Now, I don't know what William and Kate are like as parents, but you can see the appeal already, can't you? You get the best clothes, the best cars, the best houses, all because of who you are. But Moses, we're told here, by faith, chose to throw that all away. He refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And instead, he chose to identify with the people of God, right there in the middle of verse 25. And in doing so, he chose two more things. Did you notice them? Firstly, he chose to be ill-treated. That has to be a deliberate choice, doesn't it? The choice to say, I prefer to suffer than to enjoy the things that you have for me. That's a deliberate choice, isn't it? A deliberate choice to be part of the people of God. Secondly, he chose that rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He chose to be ill-treated rather than to have pleasure. Rather than enjoying what he had and being associated with the Egyptian powers, Moses chose to be maligned and ill-treated along with the people of God. The people of God. That includes all of God's people from all of time. That connects all the stories from the Old Testament to the people reading and hearing this. That connects those in the past, or those people in the past, to the listening people of this letter, both then when it was written and now today. The people of God. Moses chose to be part of the people of God, and in doing so, he chose to suffer. That's the same experience that these hearers have at the moment. We saw that in chapter 10, verse 33. People who'd lost it all to follow Jesus. Now, as I'm saying that, you might be thinking to yourselves, well, that maths doesn't add up. Why would you want to do that to yourself? Why would you choose to suffer rather than just enjoy yourself? Well, we're told why Moses did it in verse 26. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of something greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. You see, Moses did the maths. He counted the cost and he realized that it was worth it. He saw the treasures of Egypt as nothing in comparison to the reward that is to come. Moses regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. Now that sounds absolute madness, doesn't it? Absolute madness in our materialistic world. Who in their right mind would throw away all the gold of Egypt and choose to suffer instead? What we see here, we've seen through this chapter, those who have faith, that is who? Those who have faith and so choose to identify with the people of God, like Moses here. And we see that idea rolling forward. By faith, Moses left Egypt, not scared of the king. Instead, persevering by seeing him who is invisible. Like his parents, Moses wasn't afraid of Pharaoh. He had faith in the unseen, as we thought of a few weeks ago. Faith in God, that his promises would come true. And choosing to identify with the people of God comes up again, verse 28 to 31. A distinct separation between the two groups of people, the people of God and the rest. Just look at verse 28. By faith, he, that's Moses, kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. There again, the deliberate choice to mark themselves out as a people of God rather than as Egyptians, marking themselves out by having confidence in what they hoped for and assurance about what they did not see, trusting God's promise to have them for his own people and taking him at that word, taking a lamb, killing it and painting its blood on their doorposts. That would have seemed like madness to the people around them. You see, they had faith in God and his promise. His promise that those who did that would be saved and the rest would be judged, marking themselves out as the people of God standing against the rest. And those people yet again separated from the Egyptians in verse 29, passing through the Red Sea as they escaped Egypt, whilst the Egyptians drowned. In verse 30, being on the right side mattered again, being part of the people of God who marched around the city of Jericho, trumpets in their hands, marching around a city that was well built and defended seven times as God had told them, to see it toppled like a city without foundations. But verse 31 highlights there was a choice there. Rahab, that's one of the people who lived in the walls of Jericho, chose to join herself to the people of God rather than to stay with her own people, making the deliberate choice to identify with the people of God. Did you see how Rahab is described there? You might not expect someone like Rahab to be included in the people of God. You might not expect a prostitute, as it says here, to be included in Hebrews chapter 11. But choosing to identify with the people of God is a forward-looking thing. It doesn't look back at the past and allow that to qualify you or not. You see, these examples put together show us that you can come from a rich, upstanding family in the world's eyes, like Moses, or you can come from a law-breaking, despised profession like Rahab, the prostitute. It comes down to faith, leaving behind the past and living in light of the future. It was that way back then. It's still that way now. Wherever you are, you this morning, wherever you are today, the choice is open to you to have faith, to identify with the people of God. The author continues in verse 32. There's so many stories that you could tell. You could tell the story of Gideon, of Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets. You see, wherever you choose to cut the Bible and see what God's people are made of, you'll find that it just oozes faith. It's the story of the whole Old Testament. It's the story of the whole Bible. Faith. And the author here throws a number of stories our way. He uses phrases that invoke memories for the people, perhaps memories for us if we know our Old Testaments. For example, those who administered justice. That exact phrase there is used in the Old Testament of King David's reign. Those who shut the mouths of lions. Well, that's the story of Daniel, isn't it? Daniel in the lion's den. Many, many stories of those who, through faith, achieved great things. Things that everyone would agree were great. See, sometimes, through faith, triumph came. But you get a contrast in verse 35 onwards. Sometimes, through faith, tragedy struck. People tortured, jeered, flogged, in chains, in prison, death by stoning, death by being sawn in two, death by sword. Again, stories from history that these people reading this would remember and recognise. Stories that we might remember and recognise too. Stories of people going about in sheepskins and goatskins, clothing, marking them as outsiders, showing us they were rejected by the world around them. Destitute, persecuted, ill-treated, just like Moses, as we saw earlier, chose to be. All of those people, seen as losers through the world's eyes, all for their allegiance to God, all for choosing to identify with the people of God. But as we've gone through this chapter, we've seen it's not the world's eyes that matter. It's God who is the one that we're aiming to please, ultimately, as we trust in the unseen, and in doing so, please God. That is why in verse 38 there's this little comment there. The world was not worthy of them. The world gave them its worst and rejected them. The world judged these people unworthy of it. But in reality, it was the world who was unworthy of these people. As they wandered in deserts and mountains, in solitude, like Abraham, like Moses, these people pleased God. As they lived in caves and holes in the ground, these people pleased God. As they did these things through faith, these people pleased God. Identifying with the people of God, having faith in Him and His promises, can produce stories of heroes, and it can produce stories of losers in the world's eyes. It can lead to good times, and it can lead to bad times. But it's not the world's judgment that counts. That would encourage those hearing this who'd lost everything for their faith, wouldn't it? And that's still true for us today. See, it's easy to go along with identifying as the people of God when things are going well for us. But how do we get on when it aligns us with those on the outside? Do we choose to identify with the people of God when that happens? As this section has shown us, there is one, only one, people of God across the whole of history. So do we associate with them? Do we associate with the friend who is being jeered or mocked by those around them for their Christian faith? Or do we just sit there silently, hoping it's going to pass us by? Do we choose to identify with those overseas, those we heard of earlier from Sam, who are suffering at the hands of their governments? Or do we let the ocean between us blind us to it? Do we choose to associate with those that we see on a Sunday morning? Or do we walk slowly behind them in town, hoping they don't notice us? You see, faith chooses to identify with the people of God. And it's those people who receive the promise. That's our second point this morning. By faith, we receive the promise. We're going to look at verses 39 to 40. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. Since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Now, if you remember a couple of weeks back, if you can strain your memories to then, we saw in verse 2 that God is pleased with those who have faith. He speaks of God, those pleasing God or being commended by Him. And here, at the end of this chapter, the writer is wrapping everything up. And he's reminding us that by faith, all these were commended for their faith. All of these people here in Hebrews 11 pleased God. Yet, none of them received what had been promised. Hebrews 11 tells us here that none of those people, none of those examples, none of those people of faith received what had been promised. Again, we started to see that with Abraham last week. He got to the land, but that wasn't what he was ultimately promised. None of these people received that ultimate promise. Why? Now have a look again at verse 40. Since God had planned something better for us. In the sovereign plan of God, that is what God had decided. This was entirely God's plan. Right through history, right through this gallop of Bible history we've seen here, God had planned something better. And if we're reading the text carefully, if we haven't got our autopilot mode on, we'll notice something interesting. Just follow the pronouns. That's the I's, the U's, the we's. I'll highlight them as I read it again. These, that's those people, were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. You see, in God's providence, or in God's sovereignty, He had planned that the promise would come to those by faith, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. That us is the people who are hearing this. That's them 2,000 years ago. And that us is us today too. So what is that promise? How are they, how are we made perfect? Well, the next few verses show us, and it's that Sunday school answer. Hopefully you've all got it. Jesus. You see, none of these people here in Hebrews 11 got to witness Christ firsthand. None of them got to hear Jesus preach and teach around Jerusalem. None of these people got to stand in the Garden of Gethsemane. None of these people saw the cross. None of them got to see the empty tomb. But they knew that God had promised it. In some form, they knew God had made this promise, and so they considered him reliable. And so in God's great plan of salvation, all of the people of God, past, present, future, would be made perfect in Christ. That means altogether, the Old Testament saints and us will be able to come before him. That together with us, all of God's people are made perfect. That God's plan is not to have two peoples of God, but to have that one great people of God, including Abraham, including Moses, including the original hearers, including us here today. All of those who have faith, all receiving what God has promised together. Jesus is the fulfillment, as we'll think about some more in a moment. He is the one that all of these examples of faith here in Hebrews 11 were looking for. They, like Moses, as it says here, were looking forward to him. They all thought that he was worth it, that the promise was worth waiting for. So that leads us to a diagnostic question this morning. Do you consider the promise worth it? Do you consider Jesus worth waiting for? When you do the maths, do you see Jesus worth losing everything for? See, faith is how you receive the promise in Jesus, who we're going to look now at in our final point. So the final point of this morning, this is where this whole chapter has been running to. We see that in the first word of chapter 12, the word therefore. And what we're going to see is that faith runs after Jesus. Have a look at verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. You see, now that we're done looking at those Old Testament examples, we're transported into the stadium. And as we look around, we can see those witnesses. All those people we've seen over the last couple of weeks. There you see Abel, Abraham, Moses, Rahab, Joseph, Enoch. You see, no longer are these characters just detached. They're no longer just characters from a book. Instead, they're part of an ongoing story. And we're part of that story too. You see, this is our story. This is our family history. As we saw, there is one people of God. And if you're living by faith, you're in it too. And therefore, you're being spoken to right now. And what's being said? Well, it's to run the race. See, our lives are referred to as a race. The great marathon of life. The great marathon of faith. Trusting in God's character, knowing that his promises are certain, and considering him reliable. Believing that what God has in store is worth so much more than any treasure this world can offer us. That what God offers is more satisfying than the fleeting pleasures of sin. And since this is a race, the author calls us to throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. For the original readers, we've seen that might be their physical well-being, their reputation, their property. All the things that were worrying and concerning them. Not necessarily bad things in themselves, but things that were holding them back. Things that were making them consider throwing in the towel on Jesus. Those may be similar concerns to us this morning. So we've got to ask ourselves, what's hindering us? What concerns have we got? What's stopping us running wholeheartedly after Jesus? And once we've identified those things, we're to cast them aside, to throw them off, thrust them away. You see, there's a reason why marathon runners wear the least they can get away with. There's a reason why the man who's dressed as Big Ben is always beaten by the lean marathon runner in a thin t-shirt and shorts. Runners don't weigh themselves down. There's no room for accessories. And not only that, we're told to throw off the sin that so easily entangles, the fleeting pleasures of sin that we saw earlier with Moses. We're to bat it away, just like a wasp at a picnic. Cast it away. Those things are only going to trip us up and stop us running. So cast them away. Running with perseverance, the race that has been marked out for us. Longing to reach that finish line. Putting every ounce of our energy into crossing the ticker tape. Starting well and finishing well. Remembering that this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. And knowing also where we're running to. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, as verse 2 says. Having him as the only thing in our eye line. Not looking back to those things that we've cast off. Not veering off to the sides, but looking directly ahead to him. Doing the same thing as those witnesses. They were all looking forward to Jesus, as we saw earlier. Since, as this verse says, Jesus is the pioneer and perfecter of faith. Great words, but what do they mean? Well, firstly, Jesus has run this race already. He's the pioneer. He's got the t-shirt. He's the leader. He's the trailblazer. He's the one who's made it possible. He's the one who enables faith in the first place. And he's the one who can remove your heaviest weights. He's the one who can destroy your entangling sin through his death on the cross. He's the one who can renew you by his resurrection power. And he's the one who can save you from the dominion of sin by his glorious reign. He's the one to look to, and him alone. That's how you start the race well. And secondly, Jesus is the perfecter. He's the one who brings all things to their completion, as we saw in verse 40. He's the one who's made faith possible and who we can model faith on. He is the one at the finishing line, rewarding those who endure to the end. So we can have our eyes fixed on him. There's no need to look elsewhere, for in Jesus we have everything we need. He is the start and the end of faith. He is the beginner and the finisher, the pioneer and the perfecter. And he demonstrates faith supremely. That's how this passage continues. He knew the joy that was set before him. That means he was future looking. He was future longing. He lived life in light of the future. In that case, this means he was going to endure the cross, the greatest humiliation there was, where he faced greater suffering than anyone ever before, where he placed his trust, choosing to be ill-treated for the people of God. And in doing so, he paid the price for sin, for all of those who place their trust in him. All those, no matter where they come from, no matter where they lived, no matter when they lived, but those who lived by faith. Those who looked forward to his coming and trusted him as reliable. Jesus scorned the shame of the cross. He ignored the opinion and disgrace of the world around him, knowing that God's opinion mattered the most. And as he did that, he smashed through death, proving that this was the right way, vindicating those who identify with the people of God, proving that that is the best decision, showing the maths and securing the promise for all of those who have faith. And what did he do after that? He sat down. There in verse 2, he sat down because everything was completed. He sat down as the King of the universe at the right hand of God. He sat down and he still sits there now, reigning, right now, reigning until the end of time. And that means that nothing the world throws at you will ever ultimately succeed. Because the King is on his throne and he cannot be knocked. So fix your eyes on him. Jesus is the beginning and the end of faith. He enables it and he completes it. So place your faith in him. And therefore, verse 3, consider him. Consider Christ. The author encourages us to do the maths, to check it out, to think and to dwell on what Jesus did. Why? It was there in verse 3. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You see, there is a danger. There is a danger that the author wants his readers, that includes us, to avoid. so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. As I've said, the life of faith is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It takes both starting and finishing well. But there is a possibility here of not finishing, of growing weary and losing heart. I used to think this said lazy. It meant laziness. But it's not a case of being lazy that we're being warned about. It's about growing weary and giving up. And that's the warning throughout the book of Hebrews. We saw it back in chapter 10. As the pressures of life crowd in, as suffering and conflict arrive, as insult and persecution come, as property is taken away, when the things of this world become far too important, it can take its toll. It can make a person weary. It can cause them to lose heart. We need to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus and to run with perseverance, knowing that he endured even more than us, but that he pushed through and he opened the gates of glory for us. He secured the promise that those by faith will receive. It is worth it. So persevere, endure, hold on, because the best is yet to come. So how do you feel about that? How is your race going? Are you even on the track? You see, we've seen two responses over these past 3 weeks in this short series in Hebrews 11. Either we run or we give up. Either we have perseverance or we grow weary. Either we live by faith or we don't. So which are you today? You see, Jesus has proven that he's trustworthy. He has done what he said he would do, and he is now seated on the throne, proved in his death and his resurrection. And one day, he will return. And on that day, every knee will bow to him. So it makes sense to identify with the people of God and to place your trust in him. He's worth much more than anything else this world has to offer us. So why not get on the track? But I think for most of us, we're there already. And for some of us, we might be feeling weary. We might feel like throwing in the towel. Well, take the advice from the writer here. Look to Jesus and consider him. He helps us to run to the end by what he's done for us and by what he is doing in us. If you're in the middle of the race, remember that Jesus sustains you. Every atom of your strength for running comes from him. So look to him, consider him, remembering, as we're told elsewhere, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion. If you're feeling good right now, if you're not feeling weary or tired, put this away in your pocket for the day it might come. Inoculate yourself now and encourage others with that truth. It's no shock that in the next chapter or so in Hebrews, he says, carry on meeting together. We encourage one another as the people of God. We can know that the race is worth it, knowing that the promise is secure because Jesus has already won it and he's opened the gates of glory for us. So, friends, hold on to faith.
That brings us to the end of this series in Hebrews 11. I hope that's been an encouragement to you. As always, you can send feedback or questions to the email in the show notes. A new episode will drop next week. But in the meantime, let's get on with praising God this week.